ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
I mean, why didn't they just use Harry Holt's high school nickname, Puss? These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
Search The Dead Can't Sue podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The Prime Minister has unveiled a world-leading artificial intelligence framework. New national standards will be legislated with expectations brought into one clear and consistent regulatory framework. Anthony Albanese used his landmark speech to lay out the opportunities for Australia to shape the future of AI rather than letting AI shape us. It comes as Australians grapple with concerns over job losses, anxieties over the environmental impacts of AI data centres and having them in our own backyards. And while the Prime Minister says artists should retain control over the use of their creative works, there are still concerns over copyright protections. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Jacob Grieber. Sorry about that. It was like the AI had taken over my mind. I couldn't think for myself.
Oh, you would have answered quicker if the AI had taken over your mind, my friend. Have you seen Claude hold back? Goodness gracious. Okay, let's get into this. The Prime Minister has delivered a landmark speech at Sydney University. Jacob, AI hasn't malfunctioned. You're here on a Wednesday by
IRL,
design.
In real life. A human being with all the flaws.
I think you're real. But we are recording after Anthony Albanese's speech. He laid out a vision for Australia's AI future. And what I found most interesting is that he said his government would create new laws. Yes, that's right. It's legislation for national standards on AI, which ensure companies are transparent in their operations, that they manage the risks of the technology, they ensure data centres do not suck power or water away from the community. The reason this is a big deal is, well, for many reasons. The government, one, claims it's world-leading, this approach. Secondly, Jacob, wasn't that long ago that I got the strong sense in the 400 interviews I reckon I've done on this topic that they didn't want to legislate. Now they do.
It jumped out at me as well that this is now something they have accepted needs to be done. And I think the we're not going to legislate position was always a little bit silly when you consider the impact that this technology is happening. In fact, the Prime Minister's speech begins with, I think, quite an interesting reference to history. He's saying this is a little bit like at the start of the aviation industry when aircraft were invented. Well, a whole bunch of rules had to be drawn up so that planes didn't crash into each other and into buildings. Same thing with technologies like telecommunications. When the mobile phone arrived, that required a lot of legislation so that customers weren't exploited, so that people had protection from, unscrupulous businesses, so that people could transfer their mobile phone numbers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on. This is very analogous. So the idea that we were going to sort of be ultra light touch, let it rip, in a wild free-for-all, I think was always a bit fanciful. We can interrogate whether he's actually gone far enough. He's certainly, I think, talked up a big game here. He's certainly raised expectations about what government's going to do to protect consumers, to protect the rights of people who are in the creative industries, who have copyright, and protect the rights of workers who might be displaced, but also, PK, there's stuff in his speech about making them produce the additional renewable energy that's required to drive these centres and not use water on one of the most water-scarce continents on Earth. So really interesting speech, definitely raised the bar, I think, in terms of what he thinks he's going to do.
This is a speech which has Anthony Albanese's footprints all over it. And the reason I'm saying that, you would think that is a statement of the bleeding obvious, right? Like, he gave the speech, lady, so why are you telling me it's got his footprints on it? Because it's obvious. Well, I'll tell you why. Prime ministers, of course, deliver the speeches, but actually he has corralled everyone together on this one and led from like many conversations. There has been a split in the government on this. He is the one that at the end made the call to say, nah, we've got to legislate on standards. They were world leaders recently with the social media. We've got to go there, but we've got to do it in a way that doesn't scare investment. And that's a message in his speech, which we'll get to in a moment. Whether he's got that balance right is a debatable point, but he's trying to do it in a way that doesn't scare off investment, you know, to deal with that critique, which will be made by business, by others, that if you do regulation, what you do is also basically sap investment, that people will want to do their work in other places because we're too hard to do business here. He wants to deal with that critique. But on the creative stuff, there has been a push for huge deals with companies like Anthropic, sort of to kind of get almost a sort of compensation for the fact that they are mining like crazy, these big companies. The intellectual property of our artists, our writers, our creative industries. He's also ended up taking the side of the writers, artists and news outlets for stealing work and taken a strong line there. This is Albanese saying, okay, I've seen this play out in my government, but I have to lead now and I have to say this. These are the kind of red lines of engagement here. He's watched what's happened overseas. The US is the best example when it comes to data centers being built in places. People are outraged. There's so much anger in some places about all of this. And he has looked ahead and thought, if I don't get ahead of this, this is going to be a political problem as well. Jacob, is that sort of your sense of it?
Look, I think where he's coming from, PK, I reckon the social media ban has been the formative experience for him when it comes to this type of technology. And in fact, in the speech, he sort of laments what would have been had governments and regulators and lawmakers been much, much quicker to regulate social media when the harms started to become apparent. And I mean, I remember interviewing Professor Jonathan Haidt back in 2019, before he really became all that well known. And he talked about how ours was the generation of parents who'd be the equivalent to those who'd given their kids cigarettes or heroin. You know, that's how strong social media, the sort of damage it has done in the unregulated way. We've had lots of arguments about social media, but I make the point because he alludes to that very clearly in the speech. He says, imagine if we'd got that right earlier on. Well, here's an example of where I want to be seen to be moving faster rather than slower. So I think you're absolutely right, PK. He's certainly staked, put a mark in the ground here that this is something he wants to do. But the trade-offs will be significant. And there's a big lobby out there that's been pushing the government very, very hard not to put too many guardrails up, yeah, not to try and anticipate every negative possibility with technology that's evolving so fast. That's that incredible balance that has to be met. You don't want to close off, technology that replaces something that's not that efficient before it even exists, and that's a danger. But he's clearly come down on one side of it, I think, don't you think?
Oh, I think he definitely has. But he's also trying to also send the signal to the market and markets that doesn't mean anyone should interpret from this that Australia is closed for business. And I'll read you some of his quotes that I think demonstrate this. If you think that his warning about strong rules and legislation means that he is, wants to sort of rule with a sort of sense of iron fist, almost like we're going to be hardliners, it's not quite what he's saying either. His quote, it is not our goal to try and legislate for every possible eventuality or risk. That only creates the risk of Australia missing out on investment altogether. This is about having the flexibility to keep pace with change and get out in front of it so Australia can draw on and learn from what other countries are doing. I thought that was key because that was his message to all of the kind of people who make money out of this stuff and business lobby groups and everyone you just basically mentioned, that they're not talking about enforceable standards that are draconian, although the devil is always in the detail. Let's see what this eventual legislation will be.
Exactly. That ledge will be such a, you know, that's where it always comes to reality. Is it talk with no real stick, or is there really genuine barriers being put up to protect some of these things that he's talked about? Because remember, each one of those things makes us slightly less attractive as a place for one of these Silicon Valley giants to invest. Now, the community, you know, the community license question around all of this, the social license question around all of this, I think is enormous. If this is an industry where people feel all it's going to do is consume resources and cost jobs, then a politician has to respond to that. The Prime Minister will have to be able to show that this is a long-term generator of wealth, living standards, and quality of life. He did say in the speech, and I thought this was a very important point, it's got to be more than just a short capex cycle, you know, capital investment cycle where people are pouring slabs of concrete and building some sheds and putting equipment in them. And then you turn around and you've lost tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of jobs as a result. And the surplus economic value that those jobs used to create is now being created by AI, and the payment for that value goes directly to Silicon Valley. That is a recipe for political discord that I can't think of anything more quick to stir people up. Can you, PK?
Oh, absolutely not. And, you know, you can always tell the issues that are captivating the public if you listen to populists. That's one of my theories at the moment. And it was Pauline Hanson that came to the National Press Club and talked about artificial intelligence as being an area she sees a lot of community anxiety around, and we need stronger rules. And I thought, Hanson, whatever you say about her, has often got an ear to what some of the, you know, concerns in the community are. She raises it. I don't think Albanese has responded because Hanson has raised it, by the way. But I think Labor research has also found that there are profound and high-level concerns from lots of Australians, young Australians, who might be using it a lot.
Around the world, PK, around the world.
But are worried about their job prospects. I mean, have you talked to Gen Z? I've got two kids in that category, and their anxieties about artificial intelligence. They're not fools. They can see that entry-level jobs are going. They are worried about their own material future, right? Like the things that you and I got to do where we were copy kids and cadets and all of the inanity of some of our tasks, they'll be gone, right?
It's almost impossible to imagine what it looks like, don't you think, PK? I mean, what is the job that someone like a journalist does 10 years from now, or anyone, an accountant or a lawyer or you name it, an architect? There's a really interesting thing that happened in the last few days that I think we should just mention. It was a group. It came out of Stanford University. It's a short letter that was signed by 200 economists from around the world. It's a big list of big names, serious cats, including people who've run the IMF or the World Bank. There are economists like Jason Furman, writers like Neil Ferguson, Joseph Stiglitz, really, really big names. They've all written a very, very short letter. And what it's essentially saying is, unlike previous technological revolutions, they mentioned the Industrial Revolution, this one is unfolding over a vastly shorter time frame. The clock is running so much quicker this time. AI may become radically more powerful over the next 10 years. You know, the aviation revolution took 40 years, 50 years, 60 years before it became something that everyone used. AI, you just mentioned it. People are using it now. It's here.
It's absolutely here. And so the Prime Minister's decided to go down this road. Let's talk about the politics here. We've already obviously talked about the politics of community anxiety, and he's trying to address some of that. I think there is great sense in doing that, not just politically to ensure that, you know, you're politically safe, but also it's the right thing to do, right? Like if your voters, the public, is telling you they feel very worried about something, they feel like they don't know where it's going, then as a government, you need to respond to that. So, you know, that's man does job, government responds to community concerns, good, okay. But let's look at the sort of potential conflict. I mean, yesterday I think Raf and I were talking about conflict in politics. I think there is quite a bit of conflict on this one. The coalition, and we'll see finally what they say at the end of this process, but really they've been quite kind of let it rip a bit over AI. The deputy Liberal leader, Jane Hume, has been out today expressing concern about overregulating AI. She says Labor is tearing itself up over whether unions should have a right to veto AI adoption in private sector companies. She gave all these examples, which I thought were really compelling, even if they were over the top. So I don't know if they stand up to scrutiny as real examples, but I thought the framing was interesting. She said, you know, when computers were introduced, did workers get a veto over that? When, you know, like all of these advances, and she's right on that. You know, you can understand that pushback. I don't think that's quite, though, what anyone's proposing, that workers kind of have the right to say you're not allowed to use AI. And if the unions really want that, well, they're not about to get it, I don't think, from the Prime Minister. Now, the Prime Minister has the Labor conference next week. Don't get confused. This speech is timed around that conference, Jacob.
This is a huge
issue at that conference because it's about workers' rights. It's about, you know, there's a big moral question, which is very much political, ideological in many ways, about the community, you know, robots taking over, like displacing humans, the creative sector that expects Labor to deliver on its needs. Is that where the politics is at? Do you see a future where the opposition will actually oppose some of this potentially?
I think that will be politically very risky for the opposition. The potential of AI is obviously enormous, but it has to deliver for people. Otherwise, what is the point of it? I mean, if it's just to make some people in a distant country richer beyond anyone in the history of time, you will have a political backlash. That is another lesson from history. So it's unsurprising that a prime minister who heads a political organisation called the Labor Party is thinking about this quite deeply and should be very concerned.
Hint is in the name.
Am I missing something? But look.
So you think it's risky? Okay. Mm. I like this.
I think it's risky.
I think it's risky for the opposition to oppose it.
Yeah, I get why they say it, and I understand why they say it. There is a logic to what Jane Hume is trying to argue there, but politically, she's going to have to convince people that it's a risk worth taking, because you're talking about people's livelihood here. Most people probably don't mind betting on someone else's livelihood, but when it's theirs, they get real, real interested. And so, yeah, that's why I talk about for whom is the upside. And one of the other lessons, I think, of technological change, and I think the Prime Minister was talking about this at the beginning of his speech when he talked about how when he grew up at university and he was speaking at Sydney University, it was at a time when the United States went to Ronald Reagan and the UK embraced Thatcherism, who famously said there's no such thing as society. And he argues Australia took a different road under the Hawke Keating era. And I guess what I'm saying is he seems to be arguing that there does need to be a collective Australia-wide consensus or settlement around how to adopt AI, because there will be losers. Like, that's the bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, like any big change, and we've seen it because we've had a digital revolution in our own lifetimes, in our own working lifetimes, Jacob, you know, there are winners and losers. I think about the digital revolution we've had, and I don't think we should, as much as we often talk about the harms, I think we should talk also about the conveniences it's given us, which are transformative. They have been for my life. unbelievably transformative.
Well, I mean, think about this deal that we've been reading about where Anthropic, which is the people behind Claude, they want to do a deal in Australia. There's reports that it's $21 billion worth. There'd be a bunch of new data centers, presumably. So for the economy, a really, really big deal. That's an upside. But, you know, and I think the other thing about that deal is they have said, it seems, that they won't do it unless there's clarity on the copyright laws. So they're putting the pressure on the government. Mm-hmm. I've heard this from speaking to the CEO of quite a prominent resources company a couple of weeks ago. They were arguing very much against this idea of copyright laws being a barrier to the rollout. So the business sector, the people wanting to push the money into the economy, are very, very wary of this type of talk. They're running the old line, which we've heard many, many times before in this country, that if we don't open the door to a let rip, a much freer kind of political environment, then the investment will go somewhere else, to some other country. Well, let's just see, I think. And I think that's essentially what the government's saying.
It is. And I've spoken to Labor MPs who say, stare them down. Like, really, the idea, we give them too much power in our negotiations by being fearful, oh, they'll take their investment somewhere else. They need us, right? They need us. And so sometimes you kind of have to play hardball back. Because they're playing hardball.
You only get to play it once. I mean, if you don't play it up front, you end up like the gas industry. You know, that's a view, a very, very strong view among Labor voters, that was given away too lightly. And this is a similar kind of argument. You know, the gas industry said, if you don't create a situation favourable to us, we won't invest here. We won't put the tens of billions of dollars in so that we can extract gas. Mm. And that was in the 2000s and early 2010s. Now we're having a debate about why it seems many Australians feel like they're not getting a, you know, quote unquote, fair share of the value. So this is a very similar technological frontier that's landed, and the politics has to be pretty sharp. Like the people have to, you know, the people prosecuting these arguments and making these negotiations need to think beyond the next 6 months and think, what does this look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
And for Labor, it's a legacy piece. You know, yeah. Are they going to be the ones that presided over the potential rollout of something that delivered more harm than good? Or are they going to try and, you know, as much as you can, because everything is risk, but preside over something that, you know, at least remembered for being managed better, right?
Yeah.
Because everything, you know, you can't have a perfect scenario because it does displace.
You don't know what's going to happen. That's the big problem.
I know. Yeah. I love the way humans invent things, by the way. This is a whole lot of philosophical discussion that they basically can't control and cannot predict. But anyway, there's a few, like, it's wild, but a few other bits of the speech I think worth mentioning, very bureaucratic-y, but interesting in terms of the emphasis. The Prime Minister announcing the Office of AI to be established within the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet.
That feels like an episode from Utopia.
Oh, totally, totally. When I read it, because there was a drop last night to be in the papers in the morning, I thought, okay.
Headed by Rob Sitch.
I was okay, where's Sean McAuliffe? Okay. But I think we got a bit more now, like, because we've got also that they're going to basically consider these national standards at National Cabinet in August, and the standards are expected to be legislated early next year. So that means we've got the rest of this year being basically a big scale debate about how far they go. Am I right, Jacob?
That's what it felt like. He's laid out a nice big runway for everyone to have their say and take their positions. And so, yeah. Look, I think we're off to the races on that one.
I reckon we're off to the races too. Hopefully people win at the end because...
That'd be nice, wouldn't it? That'd
yeah,
be
nice. We're the real people, right? Yeah. That's the scenario we want to build. And then that one last piece I want to mention, the sovereignty piece. He talked a lot about sovereignty. Sovereignty is the buzzword of our generation, I think, now.
Yeah, well, since the pandemic, isn't it? That's the...
Yeah.
Look, I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, there is a world in which we would be the creators of AIs and large language models out of Australia. you know, that we would have the ability to not just use the technology, but we would actually build it and shape it. I think, and I have zero real technical knowledge in this space, but I read a lot of experts and listen to them. We're a technology taker on this, PK. The two biggest powers on earth have the extraordinary amounts of capital and know-how to make it happen, and that's the United States and China. Everyone else is sort of along with the slipstream. But that's not to say we just sit back and accept our fate, I think. And I think, you know, what do? Well, we try and shape it in a way that suits Australians. And I think that's what the Prime Minister's trying to do.
And I suspect if you look at the community anxiety, if he gets that right and keeps that message at the forefront, he might be able to win that debate. I think this is something where he can land something that Australians broadly think, yep, thank you, you've stood up on this, don't you think?
I think that's right. When you think about people's anxieties about waves of technology change, who do you go to? You know, people make a choice about the type of government that they feel will look after them most. And that's why I say I think, you know, that what we've heard so far from the Liberal Party is interesting. Does that do that, or does it worsen it?
It's so fascinating, and we are just at the beginning of this conversation. Next week, the Labor conference will debate some of these broad principles. The Prime Minister has, you know, basically shaped that debate. He always gets ahead of it. That's it for politics now for today. Thanks for joining me, Jacob.
Thanks, PK.
Tomorrow, I'll be joined by Fran Kelly and AFR political correspondent Ron Mizen to wrap up the week in politics. And if you have a question, send it to theparty@abc.net.au, and Fran and I will endeavour to answer it. See you, Jacob.
All the best. See ya.